Hi, this is C.K. Kubasik, the creator of The Booth at the End, and you are listening to The Sci-Fi Christian.
Welcome to The Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson, and today we have a very special episode for you. That's right, today is the very first ever Sci-Fi Christian time loop. So what we're going to do in the time loop is flash back to a past episode and take out just the main topic. We're going to get rid of the sci-fi news. We might have some listener feedback if it applies to the main topic. And today is going to be a great one. We're flashing back to August 7th, 2011. It was a Sunday. Ben and I had a chance to interview C.K. Kubasik, who is the creator of the web series, The Booth at the End. So we had a great interview. Stay tuned for right after the interview. We're going to have just a little piece of listener feedback in response to the interview. But without further ado, here we go with our interview with C.K. Kubasik. All right, Sci-Fi Christian fans, we're here today with Christopher C.K. Kubasik. C.K., thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. How are you?
Good. I'm very good.
So you've already had some interviews going on today?
Yeah, I spoke with, hang on a second, Mindy Peterman from the Mortimer Report, which is an online site about media stuff.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you've been doing a lot of interviews lately with Booth at the End starting to take off and everything?
Well, let me clarify. Actually, it's called the Morton Report. No. One of the things I was talking about with Mindy was that, we've had a lovely article, an interview with Xander in the online, an online blog from the Wall Street Journal. And then last week we were the TV pick of the week for People Magazine, which is amazing.
Yeah. Wow. Nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
And then, not much else. And, I had a sort of like what is going on? Because obviously, I love the show because it's my baby, and I'm very protective of it, perhaps more so than I should be. And then I also know that people seem to be really responding to it. You know, some people hate it and hate it very much, and some people love it and love it very much.
Yeah.
And then we've got the people in the middle who are sort of like, I don't quite understand this, but I can't stop watching it.
Well, at least they're watching, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I think we're doing well. And then it dawned on me that no one's in charge of actually paying attention to internet content.
Oh, nice.
Like, there are people whose job it is to watch movies and to talk about movies or gossip about celebrities or to talk about what's happening, you know, right now with all the TV pilots being pitched to the press. But nobody's job is to actually pay attention to what's on Hulu that's never been seen anywhere else. Mm. We don't have anyone really looking at our show except for the people who are hearing about it online. And the fact that the word is getting out, I think, again, speaks testament to the kind of appeal the show seems to have for people.
Yeah, exactly. Are you the one that's personally taking care of some of the social media stuff, or do you have somebody else doing that?
No, I am not.
Okay.
And anything I'm doing is either screwing up their plans by accident, or my enthusiasm, I hope, will shine through, and I'm seen as a man who just simply cares too much. It's Vugaroo, which is a company that Michael Eisner has partnered with and is in charge of building a slate of internet content, are responsible for the studio that produced the show at the end. It was started actually by a company called Tornante, which is another one of Michael Eisner's companies. They are now in charge of TV and film development, and Vugaroo is now in charge of online development. They have hired companies to handle the press, the social media aspects. Attention Span Media is one of the companies handling promotion for the booth.
Nice.
I'm just a man who said, I think this is what you do these days.
Yeah.
You connect with people. I got a Twitter account 4 weeks ago now.
I'm following you.
Booth, which has been a blast because I have to tell you, you know, my manager reminded me of this just a couple days ago about a week ago when the response has been sort of building. He said, remember, CK, in 2007 when you were first creating the show, you said the internet is for arguments and you wanted a show that would create arguments. You've won. So
absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about the show is the way it draws you into the moral dilemmas that are taking place, and you really get involved with the characters' choices that they're making.
Well, yeah, and I am loving being able to watch the different kinds of discussions, if not arguments, but also people really sharing things that's taking place. There's discussions about the moral elements. There's discussions about the just the formal structural aspects of how the story is told, which is, you know, unique and something I did on purpose. And people that go, wow, this is really cool, I haven't seen this before, are like, you made it wrong. And there's fights about that.
Wow.
There's so many ways for people to enter the discussion. And that's a little bit by design. And I'm really happy it's having the response it has. I have to say, for example, the blog post that, was it Dave?
Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, wrote about using the booth as an entry point to have a blog post about prayer, which is like one of the smartest jumps that could have been made. I was interviewed by somebody yesterday. I brought it up, just this idea that, you know, the man is sort of this guy who poses this opportunity for intercession. And okay, so now what? And it puts it in a new light, obviously. But that desire where we just want God to fix things.
Yeah.
Just one kind of praying, but isn't necessarily what prayer is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what really intrigued us about the show, because as I'm sure you can tell by our title, Sci-Fi Christian, we kind of look for things like that that can kind of be jumping off points into some of those theological discussions. And I got to tell you, the show really has piqued our interest in that way.
Absolutely.
The way Dave went, and also in the other direction of thinking, is the man evil? You know,
right.
And what does it mean when he's giving these tasks, some of which are good and some of which are pretty sadistic? And there's just a lot of different directions you can go with it in terms of picking it apart and digging down into the philosophy of what's going on in the show.
Yeah.
You know, before we get into the booth at the end, though, we talked about a little bit about this off air, but can you tell us just kind of how you got into the business?
The business or this particular end of the business?
Well, maybe both.
All right. So I was one of those kids who wrote all the time, you know, writing picture books and stapling them down the center so I could make little books for myself when I was a child. I played role-playing games when I was a kid, like Dungeons and Dragons and things like that. So I always loved storytelling, loved movies, would run home from school to watch the 4:30 movie in New York, which was always like monster movies or war movies, and just loved this stuff. In 10th grade, I think the real turning point came for me when I was in a class with a man named Dr. DeGennaro, Michael DeGennaro. He introduced me to Nathaniel Hawthorne and Shakespeare and Edward Albee, the Greek tragedies. And it was suddenly, I realized how cool stories could be because they dealt with the grown-up things that weren't on TV, and a whole new world of like, oh, stories can do this stuff. And that's when I began doing theater. Went to Northwestern University to study theater and film. When I got out, I started doing freelance writing for those role-playing games. Ended up getting novels that I wrote, science fiction fantasy novels. That led to a screenplay deal with New Line Cinema. And then there's been other writing, and also I've been acting as well over the years. I don't do that anymore, but that was part of my life as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the novels that you've written, and we were looking you up a little bit online, stalking you on IMDb and whatnot, and we came across your novels, and we're both big readers. I'm just curious if that's something you're interested in going back to at some point, or do you have any more plans
really
for that?
Novels just have so many words.
Yeah.
Just so many words. And I think it was Robert Towne talking about Robert Bolt's screenplay for, I think it was Bolt's screenplay for Lawrence of Arabia, and just the sparseness of it. And I've really fallen in love with trying to communicate as much as I can with as little as I can. I've been reading a lot of, I tend to read older things in general. I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
When I read like Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf, or the Fitzgerald translation of the Iliad or the Odyssey. And there's something about poetry or even Shakespeare where you're just cramming in the images and you're getting it out and then you're moving on.
Yep.
That I really love. And dramatic narrative, whether it's plays or film or television or now the internet is all about compactness. And I love finding out, you know, when I talked about the booth for a while, one of my analogies is I tried to figure out how big a store I could put in the smallest real estate, a diner booth. And that kind of compactness really I find compelling. And so this is the medium and the playground more that I want to be playing with rather than novels.
Yeah, so this isn't your first series. Can you tell us about the first series you worked on?
Well, Stranger Adventures for the Internet was a terrific idea. It was a mix of storytelling and puzzle where you would get you would sign up for this show, and every week a new character would be on a treasure hunt of some kind, whether they were looking for a lost Shakespeare manuscript or a treasure their dad had left behind for them of old coins or whatever. And they'd be running around for a week looking for clues, and then they were so busy running around they didn't have time to put the clues together, so they would send you video messages or emails, and then you would assemble the clues. And whoever helped the character get to the treasure by noon on Saturday would split the treasure with the character. A very smart idea. We never got the financing together on it, but that was the show I was the head writer on. And then I went from there. What happened with that was I cut us three very clever trailers that I submitted to the Emmy Academy. So we ended up getting three nominations for broadband content the first year they were giving out nominations for broadband content, which was great because we were up against Yahoo and AOL and Time Warner. We were this scrappy little startup, and we were getting these nominations, which is fantastic. And then once that company folded, I went and sold the show to ABC, had a startup called Stage 9 on their lot, which was supposed to be developing online content. Sold the show to them called Weirdness.com. That company collapsed before that show could get made. And I tried to pitch them the booth, and they didn't buy it, which was lucky. And then I still had the booth, and I pitched it around town for about a year until I pitched it at Tornante, and Steve Cohn and Joshua Rhimes ended up buying it. And strangely, I'd first met Josh when he was one of my writers at Stranger Adventures the year before.
So when did this idea for the booth first come to you?
Well, it was around the time, it was in 2007. I was, again, pitching, you know, working on a show for ABC, for their online division. And I really wanted to try to figure out how to build something bigger and more ambitious in scope. At the time, the whole mantra was, especially at Hollywood, and it very much still is that they have no attention span online. They only want short things. And I said, you're wrong, time and time again. I said, if you could put Gossip Girl on an iPhone, it would make everybody happy. But their attitude, I think it's a little bit of crankiness. They're not watching the content the way we want them to watch it, so we're going to demean them and say they have no attention span, which is simply not true. And I said, no, I want to build something really big. I want to build something that has scope. I want to build something that's a draw. One of my mottos is that if everybody in town is developing giant robot movies, you build a movie about a small mouse because then you'll stand out. And so everyone was doing short and comic. And I said, I'm going to do big and I'm going to do drama. And that was part of my design spec. I wanted a big story. So that's that. You should know that I tend to think of things architecturally or in terms of design. Writing is simply a tool of the design process for me. So I wrote down more at the top of the page when I began working. I wrote the words no slumming, because internet content, especially at that time, a few years ago, was sort of like what I called tiny TV. People would make things that were like TV shows or movies, but weren't compelling on their own. They were just sort of, I liked this, so I'm going to do my version of it, but smaller. And I wanted to make something that was going to, again, stand out and also have a very high bar. Whether or not we succeeded or not, I don't know. Everyone has to decide that on their own. But my agenda was to make something ambitious that would have to stand out and be noticed because it was different than the other things being made.
Yeah, I think you absolutely succeeded at that. And definitely in terms of the way a lot of other studios and shows are using web content, it's just so intriguing to me that there's a... You know, you're able to develop a series that has good episodes and has a real story arc, and you're really drawn into these characters in the way you would in a normal TV show. And there just isn't a whole lot of that out there.
Well, I credit the guys at Tornante originally, and then Vougaroo for picking up the torch and getting it out the door. But it was Steve Cohen and Josh Rimes. I pitched to them. I finished pitching. We were in a conference room, and I finished pitching. And I think I was standing at the time because I usually end standing in my pitches. There's a very P.T. Barnum quality to me. And Steve looks up at me and says, "That's really well thought out." I said, "Yeah, I was just telling my manager, I don't think I should be pitching things unless they're well thought out." And he went, "Yeah, that's usually not what we get." And I really wanted to set the bar high. And they were the ones who had faith in it. I mean, they liked it. I then sent them the first four scenes of the show. I went home and wrote, actually there's a story about that, but I wrote the first four scenes and sent them to them so they could see how it would look on the page and get a feel for how it was going to work. And then several weeks passed, and I said to my manager, Joel Newton, I said, "Okay, I'm going to go home. I'm going to write the first 60 pages of this thing. And that way they'll either hate it and we can move on, or love it and we'll be forcing them to make a deal." And I wrote the first 60 pages, and they loved them. And more weeks went by until I finally had to have a meeting with Michael Eisner, because Michael wanted to make sure I wasn't going to write, and especially the beginning beats of the story, he wanted to make sure I wasn't making some sort of nihilistic, immoral jerk-off of the audience.
Yeah.
That there was actually a point to it. And I had to sit down with him and say, "I believe I am, this is a very moral show. I believe I am writing in the New England supernatural tradition that began with Nathaniel Hawthorne and Washington Irving. And, you know, Stephen King is a modern practitioner of that today. And that I'm shining a light on immoral things so that we see clearly the choices we make as people to be responsible about who we are and how we conduct ourselves each day."
Yeah, I think the show is extremely moral, and I think to me that point has certainly come across, and I think you've done a fantastic job with it. One of the things you mentioned was that you approach shows architecturally and kind of looking at the structure of things, and we had a couple of our fans write in and wanted to know from you about...
That's awesome that fans are writing into you about this. I am so happy. You just made me the happiest guy on the planet. Okay, cool. Go ahead.
Yeah, we've got a lot of people who are pretty excited about it. And one of the big things that has come up in the questions we've gotten in is the interconnectedness in the show.
Sure.
Where slowly but surely we've started to see different ties between the characters and their storylines. And is that something you had planned from the beginning, or did it grow more out of the story and process and even the shooting process as the series went on?
When we shot the show, that was pretty much the script. I'm a big believer in, you know, I'm not a stickler for the dialogue itself. I'm not precious about the dialogue. There are story beats that have to be conveyed, but I know that actors, certain words or phrasings will sound better or worse in a certain actor's mouth. So if an actor says, "Well, can I say it this way?" and it gets the story beat across, that's fine. But the stories themselves were written as we arrived on the set. We made some cuts along the way. We expanded a couple beats along the way. But the plots were done by the time we arrived on set. I would offer that the interconnected part was kind of late in the design process, the blueprint phase, if you will. I knew I wanted to build a show after what happened at Stage 9, when they wanted something TV worthy with a big budget to sustain 5.1 Dolby and look great, but also have cost nothing because it was for the internet. Mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, I never want to have a show of mine collapse because suddenly we realize we can't afford it after all again." So I wanted something very simple. And I realized that the cinematic language we've built over the last 100 years is a lot where the money comes from, because you spend a lot of time getting coverage of the hand picking up the mug or whatever. It just takes time to shoot something that way. So I said, I'm going to just crumple up the language of cinematic storytelling and I'm going to throw it away. And then what am I left with? Well, I've got a browser window that's actually smaller than a 1950s television. This was before the iPad came out. The iPad was going to come out about a year and a half later. And I said, okay, so let's start thinking in terms of 1950s television. That hung on actors' faces and the dialogue. And I know certain things I can draw from my theatrical training, both as a guy who used to write plays and as an actor who's directed and acted in plays – what can I pull together to tell compelling stories? And then I remembered also that I've been a storyteller. I volunteered at children's museums and elementary schools here in LA to read folk tales, fairy tales, things like that. So I know, I trust my instincts as a storyteller. So I began cobbling together techniques that would, I think, build a new kind of storytelling for this genre. Other design elements were the fact that, and this is what I find fascinating, and other people really have not, as far as I can tell, been thinking this through. A lot of people look at the internet and are very excited about the lowering of the cost of the production. We focus a lot on the fact that we can use a Canon 5D or whatever. But what people aren't paying attention to is that normally when we go to a play or a movie, or even TV is still shot this way, it's designed to be watched socially as a group. There's an audience of people that we're responding collectively with. Well, we use the internet alone. And I thought, what does that do to storytelling? Even if we're using a camera, what kind of stories, what kind of storytelling makes the most sense for an activity which, by definition, is more like reading a book in terms of its solitary nature? What kinds of stories and how to tell them should I be focusing on if I'm making something designed specifically for the internet? So those were some of the things I was thinking about as I was thinking about the architectural design elements before I even got around to a guy in a booth.
You know, you talked about making it for the internet. What made you originally want to get into web series? And is that something that it's always appealed to you?
No. No, I'm in the ghetto right now. Let's face it. I am in a medium where we lucked out with People Magazine giving us Pick of the Week last week for TV, right? We were People Magazine's TV Pick of the Week. Now, that's strange because we're on the internet.
Yeah.
But I think we're in a weird phase where internet and TV is blurring very fast.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank God. But again, this is 2007. I got hired on Stranger Adventures in 2006. I hadn't thought at all about the internet. The shows I was loving were The Shield, Battlestar Galactica, 6 Feet Under, Rescue Me. Like, to me, it was all long-form cable. That's what I love. Serialized long-form cable drama is the thing that turns me on the most.
Yeah, we love.
I got hired on the show Stranger Adventures because I needed a job, and you take jobs. And I was fascinated that there was this whole new arena growing up. And I would, because I have a sense of history, and I say that with a tinge of arrogance, I suppose, because I get a sense a lot of people don't have a sense of history. I'm able to look back and think, people are saying like, wow, Netflix is building new content. That's crazy. And I'm thinking, well, you do remember that once upon a time, HBO only showed movies. Right,
that's
guys?
That's tough to imagine these days.
but right? But nobody does imagine it. And the point is that once upon a time, there was no movies. And it was just two guys with a motion picture camera and a tent sitting, camped out by a riverside in California, trying to figure out how to make a movie. And the distribution system was a tent with a sheet hanging inside, right?
Yeah.
Once upon a time, there was no TV. And it was these little boxes, and like one out of 100,000 Americans had one. And neighbors would gather around the block to watch the one show that was on a Thursday night because it was a novelty. And then cable comes along, or even before that, Fox Television. Fox was the fourth network. And once upon a time, and I bet you guys didn't even live through this probably, but they were considered a joke. David Letterman made a joke 1 year about, and he said, and Fox will be at the upfront too in their tent because they weren't a real network. ABC, NBC, CBS were real networks. Fox was nothing. And then HBO only shows movies. And nobody remembers this. But in the early years of HBO, there were these things called the ACE Awards, which HBO sponsored to give awards to content made specifically on and for cable. Because the Emmys would not touch cable at all. It wasn't considered good enough to give awards. They would only give awards. The Emmys would only give awards to the network shows. So there's been this tradition of, well, you have to, there's a new field that is found and you have to sow it yourself and plant the seeds yourself. But what's fascinating to me, and this gets to the answer to your question, why I'm digging in so deep into this, is because when Fox had to make their name, let's go back further. When TV was being built, the show that really broke out TV was Howdy Doody. because most TV shows up to that point were just radio programs with a camera pointed at it. But with Howdy Doody, if you didn't see it and only heard it, you didn't get the joke of the fact that the doll was talking, that it was a marionette. And then I Love Lucy comes along and does this amazing routines that are physical. And again, if you don't have a TV and you're not watching it, you're not getting the show, because so much of that show depends on Lucille Ball's physicality and the humor being not verbally driven, but physically driven. And then with Fox, they develop The Simpsons and The X-Files. And these are shows that would have died in development at ABC or NBC or CBS at the time, but Fox had nothing to lose. So they put on these two really weird shows that, even if they'd made it through development at the three major networks, would have died within 3 weeks. They would have been yanked off the schedule because nobody would have known what to make of them. But on Fox, there are these two weird shows that you can't see anywhere else. And so people start showing up to Fox. And that's how they build their network, because they built shows that could not have aired anyone else. And then HBO makes The Sopranos. And FX makes The Shield. Right? So all these are traditions of making the thing that nobody else could have made elsewhere. And what I find compelling, I have this little accidental mission statement I made a couple weeks ago that I was writing an email to somebody. And the first thing is, I want to make stories people don't see coming down the road. And the internet is a place right now, like HBO a decade ago, like TV 50 years ago when Rod Serling was making television, where you can play and do things that nobody knows what's right or wrong yet. And you can make really cool things because of that. So to me, it's an amazing space to play in. My friend Eric Heiserer, he wrote the screenplay for Final Destination 5 and The Thing prequel coming out this summer. He's written this amazing short story, and we were talking about it. I said, what are you going to do with it? He said, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I said, you know, in terms of the material, it'd be great as an internet series. It'd be perfect, actually. And he said, all right, it's yours. You know, you are now the godfather of this material. Go get it produced. And so I'm collecting material that I don't see how it would work anywhere else, but I know we could make really great content, because the internet space is a place for playing right now. And I truly believe if you play hard and set high bars, you'll make good stuff out of that.
Yeah, that's cool. And that kind of leads into the next question I was going to ask you, which is, what's next for you? Are you, without giving any spoilers away for tomorrow's episode, is there a chance of a season 2 for Booth at the End? Are you going to be pursuing the internet series? I know you have a short film called In the Eyes that's coming out soon. What are you working on?
Sure. Well, for the Booth, tomorrow is the posting of the last episode for this season. Last year, Tornante and Vugar were happy enough with the results of the Booth and how it was doing overseas that they triggered the option for me to write the next script. So I actually turned in the Booth 2 script 4 months ago.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And it's really fun, I have to tell you, because I'm so glad I wrote it now. Already wrote it, because I began writing it last year. I turned it in, as I said, 4 months ago, so that no one can accuse me of following the audience's lead, because the audience is on some things and wrong about other things. And I'm just enjoying the fact that I have exactly the story I would have written anyway before I found out how the show was doing. And I'm really enjoying that. And so where that is in production is a mystery to me. There are conversations going on at Vugaroo and I believe Hulu about where to go next with it. And I'll hear someday about that. In terms of other projects, I'm currently writing a feature assignment right now, a joint American-Chinese independent film that I'm very excited about. It's a fantasy. And I have written and directed, as you just mentioned, a short film called In the Eyes, which I wrote for Kate Maberly and Jack Conley, who are both actors in the Booth at the End.
Sure. Is that Jenny Ann Allen?
Yeah. And we're in post-production right now. My manager said, it's time for you to direct something so we can move you into that field, because my temperament isn't actually writer. My temperament is storyteller, and I actually just want to get as many hats as I can so that I can move as efficiently and productively forward in telling as many stories as I can. Anything I can do to take the waiting process out is something I want to work toward. And so he said, you should direct a film. You need a short film. as a very expensive resume to show people you can do it. And I wrote three really bad short films, really bad. They were trying to be directory and show off directing, and they were just terrible. And eventually I said, well, wait, what do I want to see? I want to see two great actors working. I was riding my bike up the path along the Santa Monica Beach, and I immediately thought of Jack and Kate, in part because I love them both as actors so much, but also because I just thought if I put their two faces on screen together, they don't belong together, and you immediately wonder what's going on and what's going to happen. And so I came up with a short film script for that. We shot that a couple weeks ago. I worked with Brooks Geyer as my DP, who has worked with Michael Bay and Tony Scott. I had an amazing producer, Jonathan Lynch. He pulled together an amazing crew, and it's in post-production at Hybrid Edit right now. I'll be going in all day Tuesday to work with the editor. She's assembled a rough cut, and I'm very looking forward to getting that going. Yeah, and I've got a feature assignment that my manager is meeting a financier for this week. And then I've got other projects, including Eric's Heiser's short story, but I've also got projects of my own I want to be moving forward, both for the internet. And I've also written, you know, I mean, I'm in Hollywood. I've written my TV specs and my features specs, and I've got projects that I want to get out the door, so.
That sounds really exciting. You know, Brandon, who is our head writer for our website, had asked us to ask you about In the Eyes. Can you give us a quick summary of what it's about?
Sure, absolutely. So it's only a 9-page short film. It begins with a guy waking up, Jack Conley. He wakes up, he makes coffee in the morning. He carries his coffee to a couch in a living room. It's still like just first thing in the morning. The sunlight is cutting through slightly parted curtains at almost a horizontal angle. And he puts the coffee mug down on a coffee table, and there's a disassembled revolver with cleaning supplies on the table. There's an old cell phone and a notepad that he picks up, and he makes a call, and he's taking instructions, sort of like, so is this a threat or a threat? And we realize he's some sort of criminal guy. There's motion by the door outside, light moving underneath the doorway, and an envelope slides under the door. And he says to somebody he's talking to on the phone, did you send somebody over? And he says, okay, wait, I'll be right back. And he hangs up the phone. He picks up an automatic pistol from the couch. So it's a second gun just lying around. And he walks over to the door, you know, off the sight line of the door, going up to the edge of the door, and picks up the envelope, and there's money inside. And he opens up the door, and it's little Kate Maberly standing outside. And she's come to hire somebody to kill somebody. And she offers more money, and she gets inside, but she's really not there for that. She's there because she's looking for the man who killed her mother years ago. She thinks this is the guy. She's brought a gun, and she's got to find out if it's him.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
I want to hear more, but I'll wait for the films.
One of the things we wanted to ask you about is, you know, you mentioned a little bit how the show is so much about the choices we make and about our desires and what we do with them. And one of the things I'm curious about is, what sort of questions do you want the audience to be asking themselves as they're watching the show and kind of getting involved with the characters?
That's a really good question. I guess I'm afraid I'm going to blow the answer on this because I've never thought this through and I don't have anything canned. I think, to me, it's honestly less about what questions I want them to ask than certain habits, I think, that are on the table. One of the things that's become clear to me is people have arguments about the form of the storytelling, that we've thrown out cinematic language and we're just sort of trapped in this booth listening to and watching people talk. It's a show about paying attention. You know, the man keeps talking about the details, and he's trying to get them to pay attention to what they're thinking or doing. And usually they don't want to be thinking about what they're doing. And so what I'm really curious about is, so here's a question. Are we really paying attention to the decisions we make, to the actions we take, to the consequences of what we get for the things that we want or do receive? There was this lovely post. I I was warned not to read any of the comments online, but I am thick-skinned and an idiot, so I've been reading everything. And this lovely post from a woman who wrote how angry she was. The show was making her very angry because she was really angry about this little girl who's basically this pawn between these two men's desires. You know, James and Willem. That one wants to pin up, one wants to make save his own son, and there's this girl who we don't even get to see on screen who's actually the center of their actions. She could die because of their own desires and their fight over her. And she talked about how angry she was about it, and then she said, and then I realized that there are little girls like in Iraq or Afghanistan who are getting blown up because of the fights other people are having around them, and that we're making decisions like this every day and we're not even thinking about it. Or we think about it, but we justify it. And we say, well, there's enough bad people over there so that if some little girls get killed for what we want, it's okay. And I guess what I really want us to be asking is, are we really paying attention? I don't mind if people do something selfish for their own ends to a degree, because we have to do selfish things no matter what. And I even assume that in life there will be sometimes costs to other people for us to get what we want. I think Mrs. Tyler's right in that little monologue she gave early on in the show, in the series. But it's when we do it and we don't even bother paying attention. I want people to own their decisions. Yeah. So I guess my thing is, are we really paying attention? Are we really accepting the consequences of what we do instead of just blundering around and assuming the world is fine and that we're not affecting anyone else when we do things, when we're affecting people all the time?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you'd mentioned Willem and James and their storyline. And to me, if you've seen the videos, that's kind of my probably my favorite storyline that's going around. Do you have a favorite storyline as you're writing that to you just really stuck out and you connected with that?
I'm hesitating because somebody I was interviewed yesterday and somebody said, who's your favorite, you know, who you most like or connect with. And yeah. I see them all as portions of myself exaggerated. So I don't think there is. I have to say that, and I don't want to give anything away because things happen tomorrow. There's one character in terms of storyline. It's also tough because different beats of their stories are more interesting to me than other beats of other character stories. So that, how do I say this? At certain times, one character is a hell of a lot more interesting to me within, let's say, a 6-minute span than other characters, but then that'll shift. And another character becomes really compelling later on. There's a character who does something tomorrow that, there's one character who I think is particularly, if I could be like any of them as a role model, I know who I think the most courageous character is. And that's the character I find in totality, looking across everybody from the beginning of their journey with the man in the booth to their conclusion of their story. There's one character who I think is the most courageous, and I admire that character the most. I was just thinking about this actually like a couple hours ago on the way back from a coffee shop, that this one character's journey I find really moving. And it's not the character I think everybody's paying attention to.
That's really interesting. I want to ask you, but I don't want to be spoiled, so I'll just wait until tomorrow.
Another listener question from somebody who wrote in. Wanted to know what happened to Simon, where we saw him in one episode, and we really haven't seen him since. We've kind of heard more about him through Sister Carmel's story, but we haven't really seen him on screen since, I think, episode 2. Was that a function of the actor's availability or something planned in the writing, or how did that all shake out?
One of the weird things, and you know, I'm making up a new kind of form, so I'm like, I had to learn some lessons even in the second script, the second season. This idea that I can tell the same story from two different points of view is kind of interesting and fun, like with James and Willem. But it also means that if I'm not careful, I start losing face time with particular characters, and they start dissipating from the audience's imagination. Sister Carmel was such a compelling character to me that I wanted to make sure to stick with her and not have her vanish at the expense of bringing more Simon in. It had nothing to do with the actor. Again, we knew those two scenes going in. It was a very tight shoot. We just set up shop and shot it for 10 days over 2 weeks. I think it was a function of me just having to make a decision on whose voice was going to tell most of the story. And for better or for worse, and I have my own thoughts on what I would do differently if I could build a time machine now. But for better or for worse, I decided to stick with Sister Carmel. The scenes with Simon were there. There were other scenes that were cut in the development process. But in terms of just getting a script that we could actually afford to shoot and having to make decisions about what characters to keep and what scenes to keep, I decided to weight the story more toward Sister Carmel.
You know, you talked about the different actors, and what was the casting process like for this show?
Noel Bright, who's another executive whose name I have not mentioned yet, and I have to. Noel Bright was another executive at Tornante, and his wife is a casting director. And so she's the one who cast the film. The casting process actually begins like this. It's a great little story. Jessica Landau, who's our terrific director and had directed episodes of TV, was brought on. And she was at a dinner party where she met Xander Berkeley. And she had a great time talking with him. And then a few days later, she was thinking, and she ended up facing him on Facebook or something, I guess. And she was thinking, okay, so we got to cast this thing. Who the heck am I going to cast as the man? This is crazy. Like, this part is just insane. And she thought, well, what we really need is a Xander Berkeley type, because she just met him. And then she thought, well, wait, I just met him. Why don't I ask him? I mean, it's an internet show and he does TV, but maybe he'll do it. So she sends him an email, a message on Facebook, saying, I know this is kind of crazy, but please listen. It's kind of a cool script. It's for the internet. I think you'd be great for this role. Would you please read it? And he says, sure, send it over. Because what we did not know at the time is that Xander loves doing independent films and experimental work. He's a painter. He has a whole indie vibe to him. So he reads the script, and apparently the next morning at 7 a.m., there's an email already from Xander saying, yes, I will do this.
Wow.
So that's how we got Xander.
Yeah, that's great.
Off the script. And that opened up a lot of doors. Suddenly Xander Berkeley was doing it, and so other actors would show up. Like, I know that you know that Sarah Clark is Xander's. You know Sarah, the woman who plays Sister Carmel is Xander's wife.
Yeah,
right. And also his co-star in first couple seasons of 24.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so and she was actually pregnant during the shooting of the film, by the way.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
That's an ironic twist for her character.
Yeah.
She was either going to play Doris the waitress or Sister Carmel. I said, you know what, you choose whichever one you want to do. And she decided, because of the mode she was in, she was going to play Sister Carmel. And she was, you know, I think she's just amazing. Our whole cast is just amazing. And so she came on board because she really liked the material as well. And then other people started showing up. And Noel's wife, whose name is escaping me, and I'm ashamed for that right now. But she did an amazing job of pulling together these great actors who all showed up. The way we shot it was Xander was, of course, in the booth every day for 2 weeks. God bless him. And then each day, a new actor would show up, and we would shoot all their material consecutively in chronological order. So it was sort of like a little short story we shot, and then we would wrap that actor, and the next morning, like Christmas, a new actor would show up, and we'd do it again. It was really just a lovely experience. It was just great.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. You know, you had mentioned Doris, so we did have kind of a fun question here from one of our fans. They had said, what is the man drinking in the diner? Doris keeps bringing him hot water, but there aren't any tea bags to be seen. Can you answer that question?
That must be a we didn't capture it right, because I can tell you there were tea bags.
Oh, okay.
He's just drinking tea.
Okay.
Well, there was a big discussion. Well, big meaning we didn't have time to have big discussions, but on our show it was the equivalent of a big discussion. What does the man drink? Is it coffee? Is it juice? And Xander said, I really think he's drinking tea. And it's like, all right, tea it is, because in the script it's all coffee. But because it was a very David Lynch Twin Peaks moment for me to have that much coffee going on. Yeah, but we went with tea at the end.
All right. Let's see here. Looking at our questions here, you know, did you always along the whole process of writing plan on keeping it exclusively in the diner? Or was there ever any idea that maybe you would take it out of the diner?
For me, there was never any question of leaving the diner. The whole premise was, part of the design premise was, making sure I made something that couldn't collapse financially. in terms of production costs. I wanted to make the most compelling script I could for the most economical means possible. And that meant hanging out in a diner booth, yeah, just to make sure nothing got complicated. There were some discussions at one point of, in fact, somebody on Hulu, or several people on Hulu have suggested this, of like even just cutting away the images of things happening off screen. I think that would, in my own view, and we'll see what happens if the show moves forward and new people come on who are financing it, if they open it up. I know that's a possibility, but I think leaving the booth would be a mistake unless it was done very specifically. If we just cut away the pictures or memory images, it's almost like trying to apologize for the weirdness of the structure and paper over it, sure, rather than really saying, wait, what is this show about? For me, the action of the show is not actually what's happening off screen. People keep referring to the action off screen not being shown, and it's great. I mean, the fact that people are saying things like, I keep seeing images from the show that I realized were never shown. Huh. That's amazing to me. That's the magic trick I wanted. But if we really look at how the show is set up, the action is actually what the camera is recording. The action is the equivocation, the dodging, the assuming responsibility, the dodging responsibility, the making decisions, the waffling, the struggling with desire, the struggling with morality. That's what the show is about. That is the action. The camera is pointed exactly at what the show is about.
Yeah, it really makes the show about the choices and the consequences that follow them.
Right.
It kind of almost has a Reservoir Dogs feel when you think about it, where you see everything before and everything after, but not the actual action itself. And I think that makes it really fascinating to me.
I mean, I hope so. I mean, that was part of the design. Like, you know, can I get away with this? It's a weird show in a couple of levels, and it's definitely weird in the how we chose to tell the story level, or how I chose to tell the story. There's a sense of... we're not going to talk about the bank robbery. We're only dealing with things inside and outside. And I went even deeper into that. I would say Tarantino actually was an influence on this as well, in the sense that he trusts dialogue, he trusts actors. He knows how to get a lot of mileage out of the simplest things because he really does love actors. And I really love actors. Again, going back to, If Everybody's Building Giant Robots movies, make a movie about a mouse. I remember years ago thinking of the phrase, the special effect of the actor's face. And I really, I mean, I'd love to make a big movie. I've written, you know, some specs that are crazy big. And ultimately, though, if it comes down to it, if as long as I can keep making content, I have no qualms with hanging it on actors I love to get the story told.
All right. Let's see. You know, it sounds like you had a chance to be on set there as they were shooting. And we had actually gotten an email from the director just thanking us for some of our reviews. So I know that there was also a director there. How much direction did the actors get? You know, especially, you know, Xander Berkeley, who plays the man with a lot of subtlety. Did you guys, was that natural for him? Or did you guys kind of direct him to play the character in that way?
Well, first of all, I didn't direct the actors at all. That would be Jessica. And I would say that Xander, when Xander and I first spoke on the phone, he called me to talk about the material and to thank me for the script. And he said, I feel like I've been preparing to play this part all of my life. So he, you know, like he had it down out of the gate. I remember I got a call from Josh Rimes. This was after Jessica had sent Xander the script and he'd said he wanted to do it. I didn't know about any of this yet. I've been a fan of Xander's for years, and I get a call from Josh Rimes at Tornante, and he says, so CK, we're looking at casting and we're thinking about, I just wanted to hear what you thought about this. We're thinking about, for the man, Xander Berkeley. And I say, oh, now you're screwed, because I'm a huge fan of his. He's perfect for the part. In fact, if you don't get him, we have failed. So you better do this or the show is not going to work. And I actually opened up the computer and I began reworking some lines of dialogue for the man to make it more of Xander's voice, because I knew Xander's sense of intelligence, judging, and mystery that you can see in all of the work he brings to bear would be perfect for this role. So he just, you know, he found his way through it. He is now the creator of that character to the degree that he shaped how the man does so many things while sitting in that booth.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal performance, and hopefully get some recognition for it going forward.
I hope so. Again, this recognition thing is, I've had, like, I'm not saying I would make a deal with the man. I was, but I've been watching my behavior and not particularly happy with some impatience that's come into my heart, and realizing that I had to just slow it down and say, well, this is where we are. We're maybe the show that begins breaking that open. But when you look at people like Xander and Jenny Blong and Sarah Clark and Jack Conley and Kate and Jenny and all these Matt and these just amazing actors playing these parts. I mean, the woman who played Mrs. Tyler, I remember being on the set that day. That might have been the third or fourth day, and being astounded that there was this wonderful little old lady sitting there talking about building a bomb.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great juxtaposition for her character to have her doing that.
Who the hell greenlit this? Like, it was like, this is the weirdest show in the world. Because it's one thing to write it. It's another thing to be standing 5 feet away and watching somebody say the words out loud and her doing it so effectively. We have these amazing performances in a show that trusted itself to stay simple and on point, not overcomplicate. We had producers and executives who backed the material. John Radulovich and his partner Lou showed up from Californication and pulled together the team. It's just amazing to me. The thing that got to me was on the shoot was each day on Christmas morning, each Christmas morning when the new actor showed up, they'd come up to me and say, thank you so much for this material. They were just so happy with the material. I got to tell you, that made me the happiest guy in the world. And then it was on the fourth day, I watched the camera crew, all our operators, standing outside the gate to Cadillac Jack's, 15 minutes, it was 7:45 in the morning. We can't even get in till 8 o'clock. They're standing around the gate waiting to get in, talking about the setup coming up, because they can't wait to get to work on this thing. Because everybody got invested in doing the best work they can. That mission statement I came up with, I sent to my AD for the short film just to try to make clear what I wanted the short film set to run like. I said, look, here are my three things. I want to make stories that people don't see coming down the road. I want to build environments where everybody gets to work at the top of their craft in ways they would not have assumed or guessed they could have, and find out new ways of doing their job and challenge themselves. And I want to keep people employed. Those are my three points. And if I do that, I think I'm doing the best work you can possibly do as a storyteller in this town. And that's what I want to keep working on. And that came from the booth experience. Everyone was so engaged, I got spoiled. I know a lot of shoots aren't like that. And that's too bad, because I've got to now make every shoot like that. I never want to be on a shoot that is not like that.
Yeah. You know, we just have one last question here. And I think you'd already hit on this, but, you know, you tapped into this thematically rich idea of these moral dilemmas. So to you, what is it about moral dilemmas that makes the show, not just this show, but all shows and all stories so intriguing?
Well, my friend, it is my belief that these moral dilemmas are what storytelling is about. How do I approach this? This is like a whole class. Stories are about the choices the characters make. We don't often see them that way. This show, because I basically wanted to build something that was production-wise simple enough and not depend on cinematic language or spectacle, I basically took all the water of other cinematic storytelling out and we're left with a dry powder of dramatic narrative, which is the choices we make. So it's very blunt and clear on the screen. But if we look at, let's say, Aliens, which is a movie I love, just off the top of my head. Ripley begins as a character who is told that bad things are happening out there and she might be able to help. And God bless her, she does not want to go help. She already dealt with the monster. Thank you very much. She's had her fill. And then each step of the way through the movie, she chooses to invest more and more of her presence into the conflict until she ends up fighting the alien queen one-on-one over a child she only met 24 hours earlier, which at the beginning of the movie, she never would have thought she would be capable of doing. All she wanted to do was get back to work and sleep and have a good night's sleep. So every story, if Jack and the Beanstalk, it's like, do I make the deal with the man that's going to disappoint my mother or not? Do I help the little gray man in the woods by offering him some of my food when he asks for food? Am I going to be kind to my stepsister or not? I mean, all stories are about the social dynamics of how we treat each other, and dramatic narrative most of all, because dramatic narrative ultimately is about how characters interact with each other. And if there's not a moral component to that, there's really nothing particularly interesting going on. If there is a moral component, no matter how much it's gussied up, then there's something interesting going on, because that's at the point where we turn as a society to our stories to inform us about how we want to behave, how life is complicated and we're not sure how to behave, how one kind of behavior is sometimes good in some circumstances but bad in other circumstances. All these things are what storytelling is about. So I think that without a moral dimension of storytelling, we don't know what we have. If you look at The Godfather and Michael's decisions through that movie, if you look at a romantic comedy, it's all going to be about how do I choose who I'm going to spend my life with. I understand that there's romance and all those other things, but ultimately the characters are looking for somebody they want to partner up with and trust with their children, you know, in a very ultimate way. If you look at Titanic, Rose is trying to figure out who the father for the child that isn't even conceived yet is going to be. She's got two men in front of her, and one of them is going to end up being a dad, and she's got to decide how she's going to do it. And we know how she makes her decision. It's the character of the men is how she's going to make that decision. That's moral behavior, and those are choices made along moral behavior. So it's interesting. I'm working on this. I just mentioned I'm working on this feature assignment, and I only last night, I've been sweating this thing out for 3 months now, and I've got a lot of images and thought about a lot of plots. But it was only yesterday when I saw what the moral question for my main character to go through was that the whole thing began finally falling into place. I don't know how to work otherwise, because if not, it's just sound and fury and plot. And plot is not particularly interesting to me. I'm thankful that you guys are so dedicated to trying to figure out who's going to live and die and how things are going to turn out. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, that's not the part I care about most, though. What I care about is it's not whether Randall Wallace lives or dies at the end of Braveheart. It's the choices he made up until the moment he lives or dies. That's what I really care about.
That is incredibly well put on the importance of story and why stories matter and why humans have been telling each other these things for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And
no, it's like a moral hygiene. It's like our soap. We scrub each other with stories and we say, I think I get a cleaner idea now. And again, sometimes they're very didactic and it's like behave this way. And those stories usually are very boring to me. It's stories that talk about the complexity of life and how hard life is. One of the reasons I think I can respond to all my characters is because, again, they're exaggerated qualities of myself, but I love them all because I get their problems and how they wish life was different. And it is hard to be alive as a human being. We have imaginations that can dream of paradise on earth. We all could, if we just sat down for 5 minutes, go, if only my life were like this, it'd be perfect. And then we also have bodies that are finite and damaged or diseased or aging in circumstances which are confined by resources or obligations that distract us from what we would be our paradise. So we dream of the infinite perfect world, and we are also in a very finite world at the same time. I don't know how that tension does not drive us crazy every day. And I think that's one of the main themes or notions that the main grains of sand that I grew the pearl, if it is one, out of the booth. This tension between what we want and what it actually life is I think nightmarish in many ways. And all of my characters are going through that tension.
Well, CK, we just want to thank you again, not only for being on the show with us today, but for making the booth at the end and just this fantastic bit of programming out there. We've absolutely enjoyed it, recommending it to everyone we talk to. And we just want to wish you tons of success, not only with this show, but with your future projects going forward. And it's been an absolute blast talking to you today.
Thank you so much, guys. And I have to thank you as well. Your comments and commentary and outreach to other people, not only does it help the show, but making things is hard. I already told the story, like the two projects that died before I got to the booth. Getting things up and made, that I met for coffee with the guys who produced The Ring and The Ring 2, and Neil Edelstein shook my hand before we said anything, said, "Congratulations on the booth. You got something made."
Yeah.
And so getting things made is hard in Hollywood, and to get a response from people is really, really gratifying. It means a lot to have your enthusiasm and passion for the project. And so I have to thank you as well, because we don't have money for billboards and buses. We can only go by word of mouth and the internet for most of our audience. And you guys are helping to make that happen. So I'm very grateful to the both of you and everyone on your team. So thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
All right, man.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
It's a trap.
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 All right, Ben, we're back.
We are back.
And we are ready for some listener feedback.
Definitely. And we have one final one where Skip called in about our CK interview and had some good stuff to say about it. So we'll end on that one.
All right.
Hey, guys. This is Skip calling. And I just wanted to comment on your most recent podcast and your interview with CK Kubasik, the creator and writer at Booth at the End. First of all, I just want to compliment you both on your interviewing skills. Sometimes it's really hard to direct a conversation while you're interviewing, in particular to ask really intelligent follow-up questions when you're talking with somebody. It's hard to make it sound comfortable and not stiff, and you guys did a great job. Well done on your first SFC interview. It was really, really good to hear from the creator of the show. Clearly, he's passionate about his project, and that comes through in the interview. On the previous episode, you guys spent some time ripping on studio executives for putting out crappy movies all the time just because they make money. They're not very well thought through. And I was really pleased to hear CK talk about his project and all the thought that went into it. It's refreshing in comparison to see good production quality stuff come out that is thoughtful, insightful, provocative, and smart. And Xander Berkeley is gold. I don't think I need to tell you guys that, though. In fact, what we see on the booth at the end is the exact opposite of what you were complaining about on the previous episode, and I really have got to agree with you. In addition, it goes right along with what you were saying, Ben, that it doesn't that longer doesn't always equal better. These short webisodes are higher quality than a lot of the stuff we see in regular writing coming out on television, and it doesn't matter if it's longer seasons or longer episodes. If you can tell a good story, it doesn't matter. So well done, booth at the end. In addition, CK says something nearly at the end of the interview that's probably worth reiterating. He says, if we don't have a moral component to our storytelling, we don't have a story worth telling. And I don't know if he came up with that himself or just rolled off of his tongue, but it's absolute brilliance. I'd go so far as to say that it is the moral component is the thing that makes every story worth telling. The best stories are ones that tell us something deeper about ourselves, about our world, about God. They deal with something moral. All right, sorry, that was just the preacher and me coming out. Anyway, I just want to comment on the show. Well done, guys. Keep up the good work. Well, that's all from here. I'm Skip Crust, and I'm SFC fan number 2, signing off.
So, I think that brings our episode tonight.
Yeah, if you want to leave your own listener feedback, call us at
612-4121-SFC.
Or you can email us at
anything you want
at thescifichristian.com. And I just want to thank everybody out there who has donated to the Sci-Fi Christian. We really appreciate it. Well, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono.
And we are the Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.